Ronald M. Shapiro has been called one of baseball's most respected agent attorneys and was recently named one of the year's 100 most powerful people in sports. His impressive list of clients include Cal Ripken Jr., Jim Palmer, Brooks Robinson, Eddie Murray, 2001 inductee Kirby Puckett, Hall of Fame broadcaster Chuck Thompson, and ESPN broadcaster John Miller, all of whom have benefited from the more than $1.5 billion in contracts that Mr. Shapiro has negotiated. A Philadelphia native, Mr. Shapiro attended Haverford College and graduated cum laude from Harvard Law School in 1967. After moving to Baltimore in 1967 for a federal clerkship, he began teaching law school in 1968. In 1972, he founded Shapiro, Scher, and Gunait, a prominent Baltimore law firm. Subsequently, in 1976, he founded Shapiro, Robinson & Associates, a sports management firm. In October 1998, Mr. Shapiro's book, The Power of Nice, How to Negotiate So Everyone Wins, Especially You, was published, and he was named one of the top 10 on-the-job business books of the year by the Library Journal. He has taught at the Johns Hopkins University, University of Maryland School of Law, and University of Baltimore School of Law. Mr. Shapiro has appeared as a negotiations expert on ABC's Good Morning America, CNBC's Power Lunch, Mutual Radio's The Larry King Show, National Public Radio's Morning Edition, ABC's Nightline, and ESPN's Up Close. Today is April 19, 2001, and I'm in the office of Ron Shapiro in Baltimore, Maryland. We will be sending a copy of this tape to the Baseball Hall of Fame, but Sabre reserves the right to distribute the tape or transcriptions or other of the interview to other researchers. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely.
All right. Where were you born?
I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
How old are you?
I'm, well, not about. last month I hit 58.
And you grew up in Philadelphia?
Grew up in Philadelphia through my college years.
Uh-huh. And did you have a favorite team at that time?
Philadelphia Phillies. I was born and bred and ultimately nurtured on the Whiz Kids, and then suffered the frustrations that followed. But the Phillies were my team. And the separation from the Phillies came in 1983, and that's another story, when I was an Oriole fan. We'll talk about that.
And any favorite players?
Oh, before I was professionally involved in the game, Robin Roberts, Curt Simmons, and Jim Constani, the home team crowd stand out in my mind. Another one who really stands out is Richie Ashburn. Those were my favorite players before I became more engaged in the game.
And did you play ball on any teams?
I tried. I lived in a community where, for some reason, I didn't hook up with Little League baseball. I remember going out to my high school baseball team, because I basically played looking at a reflection in a garage door, swinging a bat all the time. And the coach said I could hit pretty well, but I knew nothing about the fundamentals. And I didn't finally make a team until I went to a little college outside of Philadelphia, Haverford College. And I did make the team there, and I was a hitter, but I was so dangerous in the outfield that the coach once offered me a catcher's mask to work out there, and so that gives you some idea of my defensive capability.
I guess they didn't have designated hitters in
those. They didn't have DHs in those days.
Right. Okay. What had the most influence on you as a youth?
In my case, it was my father, clearly, and his. The connection with baseball was that he was an immigrant. Immigrants frequently embraced the great American game. He took me to my first game. He took me to my first World Series game. There are, you know, events that stand out like that. But he had an even greater influence on me because of his personality and the way people related to him and his integrity. So those values are really what influenced me.
Okay, you attended Haverford, and then where did you go to law school?
Went to Harvard Law School. And by the way, there's a baseball connection if I can give it to you.
Sure.
Needed a summer job. Talked to someone who knew someone at the Red Sox, and I was put on by the guy who ran maintenance operations at the Red Sox. And I thought I'd work at the stadium. He took me out to paint his house. But the gentleman who ran the press room at the Red Sox, the gentleman's first name I think was Maddie, got sick. And they needed someone in the press room. And that was an opportunity of a lifetime, because it was the beginning of my really witnessing baseball history, because Tom Yawkey's press room in Boston was a unique place. And for example, I remember running the place, taking care of people, and being there one evening when the then commissioner, I believe it was Billy Kuhn, the broadcaster, Kirk Gowdy, who I had helped from time to time, the Red Sox's vice president for baseball operations, Dick O'Connell, they talked about this crazy idea they had that there ought to be a night All-Star game and a night World Series. And how would it ride with the fans? And I was a witness to history because they were talking about a concept that obviously was debated and ultimately became part of the game.
What year was that?
That was 1964. Let's see, I graduated college in 64. It was the summer of 65.
After college, what did you do?
After college, I went to law school. After law school, I took a job with a federal judge here in Baltimore. It was to be a job that would keep me here only for a year, because I was going to return to a major law firm in Philadelphia. But as they say, I came for dinner and I stayed. I stayed on in Baltimore, went to work for a law firm in Baltimore.
What first attracted you to being a sports agent? Is that the proper term?
Well, for many years I tried to stay away from it and say I was a sports attorney for obvious reasons, but it's circumstance. Just by way of quick background, during my mid-20s, I was the securities commissioner of the state of Maryland. I regulated all the investments in the state, enforced against investment fraud. And there were two groups that primarily got into financial trouble, doctors and professional athletes. And I established a reputation as a fraud buster. I left that office. I set up a little private law office in Baltimore. And I was sitting there one day, and I got a call from the then owner of the Baltimore Orioles, Chuck Hupfer, who said, "You got to help our legend." And I said, "What's up?" And there were articles in the paper at the time about Brooks Robinson having made bad investments and going bankrupt. And, you know, that was like asking a kid to go into a candy store. I loved baseball, and I could go to the ball field instead of the bar library.
Were you a Baltimore fan at that
time? I was becoming a Baltimore fan. In fact, during law school, I was becoming a Baltimore fan because I had some relatives here. Certainly, American League side, I was a Baltimore fan. And I worked Brooks out of a terrible financial and investment mess. Got him on his feet probably 6 or 7 months later. That was probably 1974, 75, Brooks said to me, "Why don't you do this for other people?" Well, he didn't say, "Why don't you be an agent for other people?" He said, "Why don't you help them with their financial issues?" Well, I got introduced to a few other people, or they knew me. Rick Dempsey tells me he was the first. Eddie Murray may have been the first, but it was one or the other. And everybody kept asking me about negotiating their contracts. They didn't much care about the financial help. And what I decided was I would create a so-called holistic agency, which would do their contracts, but every bit as importantly, help them hold on to their earnings, because players would go through their earnings very quickly. And that was the beginning of my involvement in sports agency. In fact, we sit here today, and in about 3 or 4 months, I celebrate my 25th year having done that. I mean, that was the beginning back then, and I've continued to this day.
Obviously, I would think being a baseball fan helps you in your relations with the players and the contract negotiation.
There's no question, and for several reasons. One, whether you're a corporate, I'm also a corporate lawyer as well as a baseball fan and a baseball lawyer or a baseball agent. You want your clients to feel your passion. When they feel your passion, they know that there's something extra involved. It isn't just making a living. And clearly, my players knew my passion for the game. They also knew my passion for them as players and as people. So it made it a lot easier. But you know, it's amazing. I thought I knew a lot about baseball before I got involved. And then did I begin to learn. And I learned more and more and more, mostly about the business side of baseball, but I really saw the game in a different light.
About how many sports agents are there?
I would say that today there are, if we look at baseball, there are maybe 700 plus professional Major League Baseball players, and maybe 800 or 900 agents. There are more agents than there are players, very candidly. Some of them are aspiring agents, but, you know, there are a lot of people who want to be agents. Interestingly enough, when I entered sports agency in 1976, there may have been six or five. So the industry has changed that much, but that was just after the McNally-Messerschmitt decision and the dawning of free agency.
I guess there are a few women out there.
There are some women today. Sports agency has taken on many facets. There's an endorsement facet. There's a negotiating facet. There's the financial facet. I try and do them as a group. But the answer is there are women. It's a much more diverse group of people, you know, diverse in terms of race and sex and background, diverse in terms of lawyers and non-lawyers.
I did want to ask you, it seems to me that it's pretty much a fairly important to be a lawyer, since all the legal things, but I guess there are some who are non-lawyers.
No requirement that they be lawyers. In fact, much like the securities industry, which I regulated, this was a relatively unregulated business until a few years ago. And then the states began to regulate. Can I excuse 1 second?
Sure.
I can't, I'll tell you what, if this girl patterns girl number one and her mother, she is going to be terrific. I was just one question, is she healthy? Me it again? Spell Chloe. No, that's okay. And where is Kate? Is Kate at the hospital with you? Let me ask you one other thing. Are you going to call Mark and Julie and Laura and David? Okay, I'll call Herb and David and Philip. Are you going to call them or should I call them? It might give them a cheery moment if you're feeling that. Yeah, well, just call me and I'll give you their numbers, okay? I love you so much and I'm so happy you sound so well. Just tell Chloe Elizabeth to call me later. Okay? Hi, Dave.
Congratulations.
Glad I answered that.
How many is that now?
Gloria? that's my second grandchild, Chloe Elizabeth. C-H. I haven't heard that one for a while. C-L. Her name is Chloe.
We appreciate
that. That's the most important thing.
Right here. Some of these questions we're asking you are in the book, but we didn't want to get
into. Absolutely.
Okay. About how many players do you represent?
You know, it's interesting. Because we are coming up on our 25th year, I looked at some of the old articles and things. When I started this agency, I said I wanted to represent 30 players in the major leagues and some minor leaguers. And I wanted to focus on baseball, because it was my love. And I've held to that. And there's a reason for it. So today, I represent 31 major league players, and about 34, 35 minor league players. The reason was I also wanted to do other things, because I thought that if I were solely dependent and solely focused on being an agent, I'd lose some of the ability to have experience in other areas that I could utilize to benefit my players and myself. It was a good decision. So that number has held strong. Attrition affects it in as low as 26 and as high as 34.
You represent the players after their careers are over, too?
I again, not in as formal a sense, but, you know, to this day, we still give Mike Boddicker financial advice. We still help Willie Randolph when he's got to make a managerial decision. There are some technicalities about who you and who you can't represent in management, although they're loosening up some now. So we try to observe those and not have professional relationships where we can. But, you know, you bond over a lifetime of a baseball career. Hopefully that bond continues to allow you to give them advice and guidance when the baseball career comes to an end.
The 31 you represented, are they active players?
Those are active major leaguers, yeah. I mean, it's always been that number through the years.
So you don't represent any non-baseball players?
I have on occasion, but now the answer is it's been baseball players and baseball broadcasters.
Speaking of broadcasters, you represent John Miller.
John Miller.
Now, of course, losing John Miller as a Royal fan listener, I mean, it's a big threat.
Me too. Me too. That's the last thing I wanted to have happen.
I guess he couldn't work anything out with D'Angelo, or he just had his own
theory. Well, there's different versions of the story. I mean, he'll tell you one, I'll tell you another. John will tell you what I will tell you. I don't know anyone who wanted to stay in a place more than John Miller. Throughout the summer of his last year here, I constantly called the then Orioles. I have all kinds of call-outs. Director of Broadcast Operations, I think his name is Lear, he's gone now, trying to get a discussion going with respect to John's future, and he said, well, I'll get to you. No one ever got to it. And we got into the fall of that year and got a call from several clubs, multiple clubs interested in him, one being San Francisco, which was John's hometown, Janine's hometown. I called Lear and I said, you can't let this happen. He said, well, I'll get to you when I get to you. Then there was a newspaper report right after the playoffs that the Orioles were very disturbed with John's objective calling of the game not being homer enough. That seemed to set things back. And in the final analysis, with a teary-eyed John Miller in my office, we had to begin negotiating with the Giants, telling them that we might pull at any time. We never did get the call. We got the call. There was a meeting with Mr. Angelos and John Miller after John had made an oral commitment to San Francisco. And at that point, I think the Orioles did make a pitch. I was not in that meeting. But it was just too late to pull it back together. It was, and you talk about a terrible loss for you. I mean, John Miller clearly is. I represent Chuck Thompson, who's in the Hall of Fame. Well, John Miller's going to be in the Hall of Fame as a broadcaster. And it's a loss that's felt to this day, particularly as the team is going through difficult times. That's when you're really a great broadcaster. But John goes on, and as you know, you've had your own ESPN.
Right.
But, you know, that's where we basically hear him saying.
Okay. Now, the contracts that are negotiated, what type of fee does the sports agent get?
The fees vary. I'd say some agents get as high as 5%. Some agents get as low as 1%. Some offer to work for nothing in order to get a client. Our fee is pretty set. It's right in the middle. I mean, it's 3%. And that's 3% when they're in the major league, not when they're in the minor leagues. So we basically work for no fee while they're in the minor leagues. And then we have a fee for our financial management services, which are based on a percent or a fraction of a percent of assets that we manage. And that's very tightly regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission of the United States.
How do you choose a minor leaguer?
Do they come to you? Or?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's not like law practice where clients call you and come to you. It's a highly competitive business where there are finely honed recruiting arms of agencies. We are known as a very low-key recruiter. Low-key recruiting. Generally, we find minor leaguers in the draft. And we use our connections and resources in baseball to find out how people are rated. Obviously, today with Baseball America, you can get all kinds of ratings right up front. And we may go on, you know, a recruiting effort occasionally at that level. There are NCAA regulations that have to be scrupulously complied with, and not everybody does it. But that's where most of the minor leaguers come from. Occasionally, a minor leaguer or a major leaguer will come because they're having a bad experience with their agent, and someone will refer them to us. Some of my best clients, Kirby Puckett, Willie Randolph, Dante Bichette, came because they had bad agent experiences and someone led them our way or they had read something about us. But most of the minor league recruiting occurs in the draft in our case.
Bichette's not too happy about it.
No, it's one of the few times, you don't see me quoted in the papers much. I'm not one who believes you take on people publicly. I believe you do things privately and get it done. But I have, for probably the first time, made some public statements because Dante lost his job as a result of the manager's first time with him in spring training. And Dante's, you know, his batting average, his home runs, in or out of course, his production has been absolutely sustained through every season that he's played, but he played off in spring training and this is unheard of, according to not only me, but his general manager, the press and others. So he's very frustrated, and he's not frustrated that he's losing money, that he's making a lot of money. He's frustrated that he loves baseball and wants to help his team win. Thank heavens they are winning like that, but we'll see what happens.
In preparing negotiations, is it usually the general manager you deal with?
I would say that in the draft, it's scouts, and in major league contract negotiations, it is the general manager or the assistant general manager.
What statistics do you, I'm sure statistics are one facet of negotiation, but what, any particular statistics you go on?
There are all kinds of databases that are available now. Major League Baseball Players Association provides a disc with salary information and statistical information. The Baseball Register is a source. I have a partner, Michael Moss, who works very closely with me and does a lot of research. And when we do a workup, you know, I believe in negotiation it's the three P's, prepare, probe, and propose. We prepare like anything. If we were in my other office now, I'd show you, if you want to see it, you're welcome to come see it, the brief for Sean Casey's arbitration. And it's this thing, you know. And we were trying to negotiate, but most of the time we prepare an arbitration brief. And that's only for players 3 years or greater service or 2+ years. You get some idea of the kind of research that we do. It's a couple hundred pages long, and it looks at every aspect of the player. His offensive capabilities, his first half, his second half, left-handed, right-handed, his fielding capabilities, and then the intangibles that go into a player. But there's a lot of statistical research.
Some of our Sabre members have come up with some quite out of the far-reaching statistics and different facets of the game. And sometimes you see we read some of these in our articles, certain players you never would have thought would be that high, but they are.
I mean, you know, I've represented the greatest player in the third inning in the history of the game. But, I mean, you could break it down or slice it. I mean, that's the beauty of baseball. You can slice statistics any which way, but obviously when you get to arbitration, you're going to have a third party, or now a panel of parties, who you have to impact.
Right.
You've got to be fairly objective.
Now, during the baseball strike of 94-95, I believe you played a part in trying to get it resolved.
During that strike, during prior strikes, I've always sort of been, when there are labor management issues in baseball and things really break down, I sort of have involved myself or been involved by others in trying to either mediate or serve as a channel of communication. And in that work stoppage, I played a fairly major role. Speaking with owners, speaking with the chief labor negotiator for Major League Baseball, Randy Levine, speaking with Bud Selig, speaking with Donald Peer and his staff. So I worked hard because my view is work stoppages are the worst thing that can happen to the game and the fans who support the game, and so I dread them. I dread them.
How about this fall?
I dread it. I mean, I feel we're less likely to have one because the commissioner obviously sees up close the impact it can have. His family just opened a new stadium in Milwaukee. The worst thing that could happen is to cut the fan base just as they're building it in that city. And he also sees the larger interest of the game. But you know what? I've been in this game 25 years, and I felt, how are they ever going to do this? And they do it. And all it takes is enough pressure. Because remember, it would have to be a lockout by the owners that would precipitate a work stoppage. Players aren't going to go on strike. They have no reason to go on strike.
They're satisfied with the contract.
They're obviously satisfied with the contract. And so, you know, anything is possible. Anything is possible. I'd say, you know, in the past, when it was a 75% chance, maybe it's a 60% chance.
Tell us how arbitration works.
Arbitration is one of the compromises reached back when, remember, in the time of McNally and Messerschmitt, the possibility was that all players would be free agents every year from the time they got to the major leagues. As a compromise, the players and Marvin Miller gave up their free agency for 6 years. So a player had to have 6 full years of major league service in order to be a free agent. The return on that compromise was after 3 years of play, and that has now been adjusted to 2 years and a lot of days, almost 3 years, it's a small percentage of players in the two-year category who qualify. A player qualifies for arbitration. And simply put, how it works is the player, through his research, picks a salary number. The club picks a salary number. And they submit that to a panel of three arbitrators under today's rules. And they will argue their cases. Now, the interesting thing is the system is loaded to lead to compromises because the three arbitrators, that majority rules, will pick one number or the other. It's not like mediation where they compromise on the two numbers. That forces the two sides to think very carefully about the risks involved and ultimately leads to the player or the club coming to a decision to settle. If not, it goes to the panel, the arbitrators, usually in a hotel conference room, somewhat like a judicial hearing. Player and his counsel on one side of the table, club and their counsel on the other side. I just recently did Sean Casey's arbitration. We tried to settle that until the last minute. We were even willing to settle below the midpoint. General manager said he wanted to settle, but the club wouldn't authorize it. So we went to arbitration. I presented the players a direct case for 1 hour. The club presented their counterattack for 1 hour. I then had a half hour for rebuttal. The club had a half hour for rebuttal. And then I had 10 or 15 minutes for what's known as sir rebuttal. Along the way, the arbitrators might ask questions. Breaks are taken. Notes are carefully made. Very little testimony. It's mostly lawyer or agent presentation. And briefs are filed.
Are the players there?
The player is usually there. Usually there. In a way, I try to argue it in a way that doesn't create a rupture between the club and the player. One thing I say is, look, this could get tough on you. Whenever you get angry, write yourself a note. So my players sometimes are writing lots of notes, okay? But to just kind of diffuse the anger, and because you want the relationship to be good afterwards. And the arbitrators then generally render a ruling within 24 hours, picking one number or the other.
How's the deal?
We won the arbitration, and there was a large contingent from the commissioner's office, because I know most of the lawyers there, and the head labor negotiator. They said it was one of the best arguments they've ever seen. We were good. But you know what? It comes down to passion again. We did our homework. We prepared like anything. And I have a passion for Sean Casey. All baseball players would be like Sean Casey. He's known as the mayor of Cincinnati. He is such a good person, as well as a good ball player, good hitter, that he represents the game well in every way. And I was able to stand up and tell those arbitrators that I represent more Hall of Famers than anybody in the game. And I've represented the Coach Robinsons and the Kirby Puckets and the Jim Palmers and Eddie Murray to come and Cal Ripken to come. And this young man stands with them as a person. And he is. He's just a truly great person. So it was a passionate argument.
Why did Cleveland trade him?
Cleveland traded him. Cleveland traded him because they needed a starting pitcher. Cleveland hasn't developed a lot of starting pitchers. Now, I have an inside track on this because I have a son in Cleveland who works for Cleveland. We've talked about it. You know, an interesting footnote to baseball history. My son thought so much of Sean Casey, even though he took part in the trade that brought Dave Berger to Cleveland so that they would have a starting pitcher, that Sean Casey invited my son to his wedding, and Sean Casey was at my son's wedding. So they never lost the affection and the bond they had. But Cleveland did it because they needed a pitcher, and Sean Casey was a player that the Cincinnati Reds thought were worth giving up their opening day pitcher for. He was traded for an opening day pitcher. So to give you some idea.
These arbitrators,
Yeah.
They're basically non-baseball players, right?
They're basically non-baseball players.
Is there a reason for that?
No, they come from a panel of... The people who run Major League Baseball's division that handles labor relations, labor management relations, the people who run the Players Association are people who are really people with a labor background. So they pick people with labor panel expertise. So they're members of the American Arbitration Association, they're law professors. I've had panels with people who don't know anything about baseball, and that's scary. That's when you're up for grabs, and you have to explain what slugging percentage is and things like that to them. So it can be challenging, but that's the nature of it. Some of them do it for so long they become very expert or gain great expertise in baseball.
Do you ever exchange information with other agents?
Occasionally, there is through the Players Association some coordinated exchange of information. And remember, you can't, particularly management, can't engage in concerted action that's illegal. But there is sharing of information. But agents, like clubs, are occasionally. are not as open with each other as they might be to their mutual benefit, but there is some sharing of information.
Is there an association of agents?
There was, but there really isn't. I mean, there's a certification through Major League Baseball Players Association. Look, what you're seeing happen today with agents is these mergers into these mega entertainment companies like SFX, for example. I don't know if you've been reading the papers, but
David Falk.
They just had a gigantic breakup. I mean, they brought together three of baseball's biggest agents, the Hendricks brothers, Speakers of Sport, which are Bronner and Gahuli, and Artello. And Bronner and Gahuli have now been squeezed out, so there are all kinds of allegations. So if they can't get along in their own company, it's tough to get an association of agents together.
Have you ever been involved in restructuring contracts or renegotiating contracts?
I don't believe in renegotiating contracts. I believe, you know, you make a deal. Abraham Lincoln said, you know, when I make a deal, even if it's a terrible deal, I hold it close to my bosom. You know, I don't let it go. And I believe you embrace it. If I didn't believe that, then the club, anytime my players malperform, could knock on the door and say, let's restructure. It's a two-way street. So I have done some renegotiations where the clubs have said, let's extend the contract, let's do something. They had an interest, and we'll reopen. Then I'll I won't make a demand because things haven't worked out.
Were you the first to suggest deferred compensation?
You know, I was very early in the process of baseball. I was one of the earliest to use deferred compensation. And it was in Eddie Murray's first $1 million contract where the club just couldn't afford $1 million. But Eddie wanted to stay here, but he deserved $1 million in those days, dollars. And we recognized the club's need to kind of let Everett Bennett Williams develop the franchise, develop the market, and we worked out a deal where they agreed to pay him, but they paid it to him later, and it was very successful. It was a win-win. Interest on some of them, no interest on others. It depends. But interest is obviously important because interest makes the present dollar value be the present dollar value.
Who are some of the players you represent now?
Today, active players. Cal Ripken Jr. and Ryan Kohlmeyer on the Orioles, Sean Casey and Michael Tucker on the Cincinnati Reds, Dan Wilson and Jeff Nelson on the Seattle Mariners. On the Red Sox, Trot Nixon, Brian Dalbach, and Dante Bichette. On the Florida Marlins, Jason Grilli. On the San Diego Padres, Ben Davis. On the Montreal Expos, Graham Lloyd and Michael Barrett. On the St. Louis Cardinals, Steve Kline. I mean, they're coming to me, but I mean, you said some, so those are. On the Cleveland Indians, Paul Shuey. I don't negotiate for Paul Shuey. I recuse myself from those negotiations. My partner, Michael Moss, handles those negotiations.
Because your son's here?
Because my son. I mean, I could. I mean, lawyers, brothers negotiate across the table, but I want to avoid any appearance of impropriety.
Can you describe a typical day, if there is such a thing?
Well, for me, a typical day is a little different than some other people, because today we're sitting in my law office. And for many years, I practiced law here and baseball in my baseball office up in Hunt Valley. And now I practice less law because I'm a counsel to this firm. But I saw you had the book, The Power of Nice. I'm chairman of the Shapiro Negotiations Institute, and I teach negotiations all over the world. So a typical day is, if you want me to isolate it in the context of my role as a baseball agent, it's spent reviewing my client, first reading the newspapers during the baseball season to see how people perform the night before. That's always intriguing. And second, to get on the internet and see whether there are any stories going on inside baseball, which I ought to be tracking in the context of what I do, or having Michael Moss, my partner, get on the internet and supply me with information. Third, I start phone calls. And that starts a little later in the day, because baseball players tend to sleep late because of the way the game is structured in terms of playing late. And I talk to players. I have a calling list that's created for me every week to make sure I'm touching base with everyone, regardless of whether they have problems or not. Then I'm dealing with problem issues. Yesterday, I had to entertain a proposal from a club on a long-term contract for a player. Then I had to analyze that contract in the context of other contracts
present the analysis to the player, get the player's decision, go back to the club. Now, that's a typical day during the season. A typical day in January or February, I may be spending the whole day doing research or reviewing Michael's research and putting together arguments and presentations on contract negotiations. I probably speak on a typical day to a couple of general managers, either on relationship-based calls or specific issues that exist. Yesterday, I spoke to the mother of a draft pick about whether she should release her medical records to a club and how you release medical records to a club. I spoke to someone about an endorsement possibility for a client. I spoke to the person who does business management for Cal Ripken about the project for his baseball schools in Aberdeen. A lot of telephone work, some face-to-face work. I still give advice to the major league umpires who decided that Richie Phillips shouldn't be their leader any longer. And I spoke to three umpires yesterday because there were issues that came up with them. A typical day might involve speaking to a baseball owner about the impending labor issues. So there's no typical day, but there's a lot of baseball telephoning and calling and relationship stuff that goes on in the course of the day.
You represent the new baseball umpires association?
What I did was, I thought that the harm that Richie Phillips and his approach to the umpires that brought to baseball was so great that when he implemented that faulty strategy of having them all resign and they were all about to lose their jobs, I had relationships with him. I helped Steve Palermo after he was shot. I had helped John Hirschbeck when his son was very sick in terms of helping with the hospital, and then I had helped him during the Alomar incident. So I knew umpires. And I took over the leadership of reorganizing opposition to Richie Phillips. By the way, in a revised edition of my book coming out in October, the last chapter of the book is all about the umpires. And the bottom line is, I would not accept pay. I never have anything I've done outside of my agent role. I didn't want to accept the job as successor executive director to Richie Phillips because I didn't want to become Ron Shapiro versus Richie Phillips. I just guided them on a volunteer basis, helped them restructure, and then found them lawyers. One lawyer happens to be friend in this law firm. Another lawyer happens to be a labor lawyer in another law firm in Baltimore. So their representation is Baltimore-based, but I am not professionally engaged with the umpires. I'm just professionally satisfied, except Richie Phillips has filed a lawsuit against Bud Selig and me and a group of others. We'll deal with that in time.
What do you think was your toughest negotiation?
Toughest negotiation was probably Cal Ripken's 1992 negotiations. Tenacious lawyer, high-quality lawyer on the other side, Larry Lucchino. He was every bit as strategic as I was. Cal's desire was to stay here. The Orioles' desire was to pay him well below the market. Their view of the market was different than our view of the market, let's put it that way. Public pressure to keep it out of the press, just a whole array of things. Plus, it took 344 days, I think. It took almost a year. So that was a very, very difficult negotiation. But there were other challenging negotiations. My first negotiation for Brooks Robinson was very difficult because it was my first negotiation. And the Orioles cut the legend 20%, and I was indignant, and I wasn't real well-versed in contract negotiations in the baseball world. But I'd say that Cal was the greatest challenge, and second probably Kirby Puckett in Minnesota that same year.
Can you talk about incentive clauses, how you arrive at them?
Well, the public's perception of incentives is sometimes skewed the wrong way. You can't have incentives based on batting average. You can't have incentives based on performance, except in the very limited area of awards won by a player. So the only kind of incentives you can use are incentives based on plate appearance, incentives based on games pitched, incentives based on games started, incentives based on games appeared. And there could be any number of things like that, which are quantitative kinds of incentives, which go to the fact that the player is playing. There are certain award incentives you can use, and this is where you get a little bit creative. For example, different dollar amounts for being the MVP, second to fifth in the MVP, fifth or sixth up to tenth, and you can have different dollar rankings for that in the voting. Rookie of the year. So award incentives are legitimate incentives. Cy Young, Role A's award. Those are ways to add additional dollars to contracts based on the performance of a player.
But it's a team game.
That's why batting average, that's why fielding percentage, that's why home runs, all those things are taken out of the incentive category. But you know, all sports should be team games, and they all have incentives, unfortunately. The incentive that is based on plate appearances and how many games started, which really goes to if the player healthy or not, doesn't take too much from the team game. The award incentives are at such a high level that it doesn't really detract from the team game. So the very reason that you say it's a team game is why batting average, home runs, RBIs, all those things are unacceptable incentives and in fact are not, they violate the rules.
Do players take out insurance on themselves?
Young players take out disability insurance on themselves. Older players that sign long-term contracts, the clubs take it out to protect the contract.
Like the Albert Dell.
Players in the draft will take out disability insurance. Players coming up on a free agency year may take out disability insurance. A young player who's going year to year, not on a long-term contract, may take it out. But you point out Albert Dell. The Albert Dell-type situations are making disability insurance, and it's only total and permanent disability that qualifies, so expensive that players have to think twice about it. You know, well, one time you could get it for $2,000 or $3,000 a year, now it may be $12,000 or $15,000 a year per $1 million. But some players do self-insure.
Do you think the current players are overpaid or
anything? That's a challenging question, because in a societal sense, I think all entertainers are overpaid. I mean, you know, but I live in a capitalist society. I don't live in a socialist society, meaning I would pay people who do medical research, teachers and others more, and entertainers less. And now you ask, why do I use the word entertainer? Well, the plain and simple fact is that what we live with today is a player who is an entertainer. Our industry has changed, even in the years that I've been in it, from a sort of sports leaning towards entertainment industry to an industry that is almost pure entertainment. So do I think $25 million a year is an astronomical sum? It's off the wall. It doesn't relate to reality. But I also think $25 million a movie for Sylvester Stallone or $125 million a year for Elton John is ridiculous. But what we're dealing with are people who are looking at business and entertainment angles. Tom Hicks, the owner of the Texas Rangers, thinks $25 million is cheap. There was an article in Forbes this week about how much money he's making as a result of signing Alex Rodriguez. So I'm torn every which way in terms of what's right. And the issue is much bigger because we have big markets and small markets and large revenue teams and small revenue teams. So that has me torn. But let me go the other way. Do I think salary caps are the answer? I don't know of any business in our society where people's ability to earn are capped, except the sports business. And I'll never forget, during the last work stoppage, I came up with an idea. I said, suppose we could get the players to cap their salaries, this two group of owners. Let's cap ticket prices. And let's cap hamburger prices, because the fan has to benefit from the cap. Oh, you can't do that. That's capitalism. It's our problem. And the answer is, the players will make the same argument. So as long as that attitude exists, I say, it's not too high because the industry is driving it until there is a clear agreement that the fan is the beneficiary. But I don't think that's about to come from either side. I hope that's a direct enough answer.
Once in a while, we read in the paper about a player switching agents. Mm-hmm. When they sign a contract with you.
A year-to-year contract. Just year-to-year. So they basically should be able to do it at any point in time. It's my wife. May I take a break?
Yeah.
How much more time do you need?
Do you have access to contracts of players who you do not represent? In other words,
Oh, yeah. There is through the Major League Baseball Players Association and Major League Baseball, there's a document called the Joint Exhibit. And on the Joint Exhibit is every contract, not all the language provisions, but all the financial provisions of the contract.
I was mentioning that so you could compare and
you can do that, yeah.
Do you suggest to players that they contribute a certain amount of their contract for charitable causes?
I'm lucky. I represent players who get it before I have to suggest it, although I do suggest it. There's a saying that I live by in my Negotiations Institute office. There's a saying on the wall, and it is an old Winston Churchill quote: "You make a living by what you get, you make a life by what you give." And I really do try and communicate that to the players. And when I think about how lucky I am and what a wonderful group of people, and if I can just highlight just some of the things players do. In Minnesota, there are kids who go to the University of Minnesota as Puckett scholars who would never go to school and could never afford it because Kirby created an endowment known as the Puckett Scholars. There are kids in third world countries who get heart surgeries because of Kirby's efforts with the Children's Heart League. In Baltimore, there are adults who read because of Cal's involvement with the Ripken Learning Center and his commitment to literacy. In Seattle, there's a program for homeless kids, an educational program, completely funded by Dan Wilson and his wife, Annie. And the list goes on and on. And to me, that accomplishment parallels any accomplishment they have as baseball players, and it lives long beyond their baseball careers. So important.
Right. Now, these players who sign these multi-million dollar contracts generally do.
Very conservative people, by the way. I created an investment advisory committee. We spent a lot of our time kicking tires. The players are sold all kinds of bill of goods by their, quote, best friends and hangers-on about investments. That's why you read about so many bankruptcies and so many of them ultimately go bankrupt. And we spend a lot of time sorting through those things and keeping players out of bad investments. And just, they have a short earning opportunity, but a great earning opportunity if they're stars. And we try to prove to them that they're just conservative and conserve, maintain a budget, don't live like the guy in the next locker with all the cars and all the houses. They can have a very productive life as a result of their baseball involvement. So that's a major task that we perform.
Has anybody mentioned about the stock market? Because I guess some of them want to use the stock market.
Some, but we're very, very diversity oriented in terms of investments. And we try to create a balanced, conservative portfolio. So like Jose Canseco set up an investment company and proclaimed to all the baseball players that he was getting rich in tech stocks. And when the tech stocks fell, he didn't proclaim anything anymore. Our players did not get tech stock crazy. They got balanced stock and debt and equity investments, and they haven't had extreme fluctuations. But they see some.
What might Major League Baseball do to narrow the competitive difference between the big market and the small market?
I think the first thing they have to do is they want to engage the Players Association in a dialogue. My friends in the big revenue markets say, "Can you believe Bud's talking to those guys?" And the guys in the small revenue, "Can you believe them?" So they're not getting along real well. But meaningful revenue share, it's worked in the National Football League. They started out with real revenue share, and then they went to the players and got salary restrictions and limitations. And it's, we see the Ravens win one year, somebody else wins another year. Now, baseball has not been quite the problem. It picks itself as having. I mean, was there ever an era that was worse from the standpoint of lack of competitive balance than the reign of the Yankees in the 20s and 30s? I mean, it was long, and the same teams won and the same teams lost. So even when salaries were restrained, there were rich clubs and poor clubs and big clubs and little clubs. It's not a lot different today. I mean, different teams do win. The problem is it's much more under the microscope because of the media and because of the fact that players do get big salaries. But I start with revenue share.
Do you think that Can you project the state of baseball, say, 10 years down the road?
Only based on my inability to project it in the past. And what I mean by that is, you know, when I did a $3 million contract for Kirby Puckett, and it was the breakthrough contract at the time, I said, well, how can it get any bigger than that? How can it get any higher? And you see where we are today, that when it goes to baseball salaries. But I think I've been a pretty good predictor about the fact that baseball, for better or for worse, would become and is becoming and will become even more an entertainment item, meaning the television industry is so in need of product that it will continue to be bought as a product. By the way, probably not as much by the networks as by the cable companies, but it will be continue to be bought as a product. Money will continue to play a predominant role in the game, all of which will frustrate those of us who love the game as the game. But the business aspects are there. People like my son, who's the general manager designate in Cleveland, are going to have to do a lot of sharpening of pencils and analyzing of dollars, which wasn't part of the game 25, 30 years ago. They didn't have to worry about that. They made a budget, and they kept to their budget because nobody could break their budget. So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it is the game, the basic game between the lines, although they'll adjust the strike zone several more times, although they'll quibble over the designated hitter, although they'll change uniform style, the basic game will remain very much the same. That's the enduring quality of baseball, and I think if they tamper with that, then they may as well create whatever that crazy football league is, the XFL or something else, and watch it go up in ashes.
But I wish you could do something about turning off the music.
Well, you know, I have to tell you that as a purist, I might feel that. But I do watch the younger fans, and I do watch the people who are entertained by it on the nights when the music isn't working, and they're a little bit lost. And so we have to understand that it is battling for the same entertainment dollars that the movie house is. Here we have baseball, and the hockey playoffs are taking place. Here we have baseball, and the basketball playoffs haven't even started yet, okay? So it's a different kind of business today, and you got to get as much of the fan base as you can to make it work. And let's not in any way delude ourselves. Baseball was always a business. If you read Kramer's book on Babe Ruth, I mean, what do you read? You read about Babe Ruth, but you read about an industry, a business. It was run differently.
Yeah, Bert Salomon's book on Where the Yanks, about the 1990.
It goes back to the 19th century. I mean, the changes in leagues, the spells, it was always a business. And so I think music will remain a part of it because of the competition for the entertainment dollar. But the game will be the game. And if, as I say, if they try to alter it to make it fit some modern concept of play, I think then the game will be, it'll be like a movie that did or didn't make it. It'll be on for some, off for many, many more.
What advice would you give a youngster today who wanted to follow in your footsteps?
I do it 10 times a week. I get emails and I get letters, and I say, and this isn't trite, I truly believe this, get the best and most well-rounded education you can get. Because if you're going to advise other people, don't be so narrow that you don't know what the rest of the world and the challenges that the rest of the world present are. Take the education as far as you can afford it. If you can get a law degree, get a law degree, because that's going to give you a professional discipline that will not only help you be a better advisor, but will give you something to fall back on, because the industry is so competitive. You're going to need to make a living beyond your agent days until you get your lucky break, because I got mine early in my career. And then never give in to the temptation to sacrifice your integrity, because it's your stock and trade. I've lasted this business 25 years. I've seen a lot of people come and go. Some of them have been flashes in the pan and superstars as agents, but they have disappeared. I endure. I'm not the biggest. I don't make the most. I'm not doing all those things, but I endure with great players and a great history, because I haven't let my integrity go. And so that's the last thing I tell them as they move into this zone.
Back in the early 80s, well before this book came out, I always felt that if I were ever an accomplished Major League Baseball player, that I would want you as my agent. know, it would be hard on issues for some people that resonate with them. And I just want to say that I've admired you.
Not everybody does. Not everybody does. I mean, there are many people who choose other agents. But it's a values choice. We share values. And to me, that life is values and values choices. And I've been one of the lucky guys. I've got a roster of players from the day I entered this game to today who are people who want to be hard on issues and soft on people. And they want relationships. And their what they have found out is careers end and relationships are really all you have. And so it's very important, but I appreciate that comment.
Got a question about feelings.
Yeah.
During the time he was acting commissioner and the strike and everything, he had very bad PR. And I've never been a fan of feelings, especially when he proposed a replacement for him in the replacement game. When, as the commissioner, he's supposed to be acting in the best interest of baseball. That, to me, was not the best interest of baseball.
I think you delude yourself to think that the commissioner will act in the best interest of baseball unless you define what baseball means. To the commissioner, be it Doug Seelig or Louie Kuhn or Kennesaw Mountain Landis, baseball means the ownership of the game by a group of people, franchise owners. That's the best interest of the game, and serving their needs. Lip service is given to serving the needs of fans. Lip service is given to we're all in this together in terms of players. But the commissioner is a representative of the owners.
But Giamatti had stayed alive.
Maybe if he had. He had started to do it. And you know what? He had started to engender opposition early in his... We just don't know. I mean, if John Kennedy had stayed alive, what would have happened to history? But with the exception of Bart Giamatti, most commissioners have served the needs of the game, which is really the needs of the owners. And by the way, I'm not saying this in a negative way. I'm saying it in a way of historical observation. And for someone to truly serve the needs, I mean, does a Republican president serve the needs of the people or the needs of people who have Republican leanings? Does a Democratic president serve the needs of the people or people who have ideology? It's so hard to understand what it really means. But the word best interest of the game to me means the best interest of how the game works for its constituencies, the owners, the players, the fans, even the umpires, okay, all involved with the game.
Also, Randolph has also gotten a lot of bad PR here, but yet he's done so much for Baltimore with his charitable contributions and so on. Is there any comment about that?
There's no question that, he views me as a quote, an enemy, unquote, so at least that's what he tells people. Because of the John Miller incident, I try not to harbor negative energy towards people. There is no question that he is a man of vast resources, and he's given some of those resources back to the community, and that is commendable in every way. And I would only hope that he would continue to do it, because few people are as privileged as he is to have the kind of resources that he has. So I think it's terrific. Now, does that define him as a baseball owner? A lot of people say no. I mean, it defines him as a philanthropist and not as a baseball owner. But I hope he continues to be a philanthropist, and I hope he ends up being a great baseball owner. But at this point, the jury's out. And I think really, without pointing the finger at him, the Orioles, to me, strategic planning is vital in business, and the corporations I advise, it's just as vital in baseball. You got to plan from the lowest level to the top. You have to have a real player development program. And I don't know if that's being delivered or not, because I haven't examined it, but a lot of baseball people say the Orioles are winning in that area.
Any questions about the book that you want to ask Richard Brown?
I wish I had time to read it too.
If you read it and you have other questions, you certainly can call me. I mean, I've read this. What you're doing is important. And just pick up the phone and give me a holler, and I'll be glad to supplement.
You're actually not accessible?
I'm not, but I make myself accessible. Because Gloria, you call Gloria, she'll figure it out with me. I'm on the road a lot with them, giving lectures or teaching or doing baseball stuff. But
yeah, one of our members mentioned that you had mentioned college, but it was some sort of baseball management type of thing, and you and After the last session, you and Bud Selig were there.
Yeah, this was at Princeton, up at Princeton. And Bud and I and the guy who was the chairman of the poker from the Federal Reserve Board is on all the baseball committees, and Fred Wilpod. It was interesting. It was an interesting experience.
Well, we really want to thank you for the time.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's really enlightening, and you've answered a lot of questions.
I'm going to answer my wife again.
Okay, we're figuring it out.